woke up to, you're going to laugh at this, 28 degree weather outside. So it's a little chilly in the house.
It's the opposite here. So I don't know what, it's really warm out. I didn't check the temperature. But what happens is it's raining. And so the rain freezes when it hits the ground. So there's a several millimeter thick coating of ice on everything. So I normally get up and I walk to Starbucks, which we talked about. And today I decided, no, I can't walk. Like it's this, any incline or decline slope, I would be down because it's basically skating. So I drove slowly.
Yeah, oh, wow.
First time I've ever had to drive because of the weather conditions just to get a coffee. That's humiliating. Oh, weather's one, John zero. What an amazing environmental hazard to drop into a five-room dungeon. Freezing rain if it's on the outside, and if it's on the inside, more freezing rain. And just the lack of traction that I had on my little, you know, 2 degree, 3 degree mm-hmm. driveway just boggled me. I was grabbing onto the wall, right, so I could stay up. Yeah, just amazing. So I don't know what that would be. Disadvantage for life on everything? I don't know.
So I was thinking about that too with terrain. We have a small little glade that we can hike to, and it's a 45 degree angle incline. So you're having to lunge going up.
That's steep. Very, very steep.
And I would say, I mean, even if you were a skilled athlete, I mean, I'm not athletically skilled, but it imposes more than disadvantage. And that's kind of what I was thinking about. Like, as far as that statistics, I was thinking of like ways to really drive home the feel of slippery ice, where even if you are great at walking, you can't go 5 feet without busting your butt. So like, what do? Every 5 feet you move, you do a dex save to see if you fall, things like that.
Yeah.
Or just hand wave and say, movement is canceled. Unless you succumb yourself to the slip and the slide, which would be fun for some players to be like, ooh, I wonder how far I could slide.
Yeah. That's perfect. At least in Edmonton here, walking on ice like that is a skill. So in real life, you're making an alertness check of some kind. If your mind is on the task, then you will not fall unless it's actually physically impossible to stay upright. Like you will see in the YouTube videos of delivery people trying to deliver packages on icy driveways. They call it walk like a penguin. So it's basically just equal weight distribution in small distances. So you're never putting too much weight and putting your center of mass outside of what you're used to. And this is where I don't know what I'm talking about. And so then you can walk on ice, no problem. So that's a skill. And to me, it's about focus and attention. So as soon as your mind wanders, you're down. And if you don't know that technique, at least for our kind of ice, that's weird, eh? Because in RPGs, we would just normally go to strength check, a dexterity check. It's like some raw power.
Yeah, that's a good point. What if it was a concentration
check? Concentration, yes.
Or you can't do both at the same time. You can walk or attack, but you can't do both.
Yeah. Spit out that gum, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. One thing. You've got one job. That's
it. I was thinking about that too, to increase a challenge for a time, impose some kind of limitation that only allows for one action or only allows for one hard choice.
Yeah.
I think that's really good too. And then give the hope of releasing that limitation.
Yeah.
There's so many other ways I'm trying to think of besides just saying roll twice, take the higher or take the lower. But I did do a small query and a lot of players were like, but I like rolling lots of dice. There's something exciting about rolling two D20s. And then even with disadvantage, that's still exciting. So I was trying to figure out ways to say, like, figure out like, how can you roll lots of shiny math rocks? because that's sensual. It's physically experiential.
Yeah,
if there's something. Yeah, and I personally love that sound of.
Yeah,
it's so appealing. So I can see why giving players that incentive to roll more dice is exciting. But I think
one thing I'll make a note of is I'm a partially a kinesthetic learner. So I like having to tie physicality with basically memory. And so I have, and that actually dovetails into other things. So I like the feel of carpet, for example, on my hands. You know, you rub it on your hands, it gets warm, it feels good. So it's that kind of thing. Anyway, so I asked people, anybody who went to Las Vegas from Canada for years, to come back with a pair of Vegas dice, of casino dice, because they have such sharp corners. And so when I roll them, it's just, yeah, it's perfect. I love rolling these sixes, especially if there's like four or five. Any more, you can no longer get the corners. There's not enough. My hands are too small. But yeah, I get those corners working on my palms, and it's just really, tingly, tactile. Yeah, that's, and then for learning, I usually have a toy, and then I will be doing patterns on my hand or something as I'm learning, and it just seems to keep the brain focused on what it's supposed to do instead of things it's not.
When I first started playing with my kids, I was strict about having just pencil and paper and focusing on the audio of the game, the auditory education. And over time, I realized, especially my middle child was way more tactile. So I've allowed things like Play-Doh at the table. And we've experimented with different kind of fidget toys. And a lot of them, if I didn't allow a fidget toy, guess what became the fidget toy?
The pencil and paper.
And the dice.
Oh, the dice.
Stacking the dice. Oh, yeah, okay. And then it toppling over and just creating this gargantuan mess, disrupting the game. So we've experimented with a couple of fidget toys and finally landed on Play-Doh because it's silent. And after our games only go about an hour, maybe an hour and 30 minutes. And at the end of that, there's this craft of the monsters, the witch's hut, anything that occurred in the game, little Play-Doh miniatures. It's nice. Absolutely perfect for the fidgeting and the kinesthetic learner.
Very cool.
Which, you know, I don't know if this is pretty much every game, but it seems like there's a fantasy with drinking ale in a tavern when it comes to RPGs. And I think about like the social, I mean, at least what I've read about, and I think what occurs most of the time is that you go to a tavern to socialize. You go to a tavern to get the gossip and chew the fat and hobnob. And in a sense, you know, before social media and digital expressions and communication, that's where you got your information.
Yes. Yeah. The community. Yeah, absolutely. And before potable water, that's how you got your liquids.
Yeah, absolutely. Safe to drink.
Yeah. Wine or some kind of ale. I don't know enough history to comment on this wisely, but yeah, the manufactured drinks were quite often safer in certain regions at certain times.
So. I've only had one player insist, no, I drink only water in the game. And now I'm thinking, like, it never occurred to me to check to make sure that water was safe to drink.
Yeah.
But I guess in a fantasy world, a lot of times, like, I guess they could clean the water. I don't know. I never explored that world building tip.
Anytime I want to disabuse my players of stuff like that, I show them the source. So, oh, you see the innkeeper open the door outside with a mug in his hand, an empty mug. You can see just beyond, he's walked down the steps. There's the, I've just forgotten the word, but that's the box that the horse drinks out of. He dips the mug into that, and then he comes back in. Moments later, he shows up at your table, and then there is a fresh, cold, water-filled mug before you. Help yourself.
Absolutely. That's a hint. That's wonderful. Yeah, so the players, they can use that hint to infer the information.
Yes. Yeah, sure. Perfect. Don't tell. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Classic.
Yeah, that's good too, especially if you want to, like you always want to put danger and risk in the game, but the art of building up to it is a technique that's learned over time, because you could just drop like, boom, a monster shows up and it's like, okay, random. But if you hint at it, then the players are almost expecting it. And then when it happens, it's like, oh, I knew it.
Yeah, the payoff. Yeah. It's kind of like a good stout. My friend Django is a master at that. So I really disliked for many years minimalist thrillers. So there's one with a couple that are in water, and so sharks start bumping them and whatnot. But it starts out with them kind of speculating for the audience's benefit about the dangers that are in the water. And then there's a minor attack, I think a jellyfish, spoilers. And then, you know, it keeps ramping up and up. And so Django would do the same with the signs of the monster before its lair, and then the signs of the monster in its lair. But in a Hitchcockian fashion, we had no idea what the monster was. We saw claw marks, but we also saw other things that said, okay, well, what is this? And yeah, just a really delicious drama built up over time. And so I was saying, like a stout, like I'm used to drinking a Coca-Cola or a Pepsi. You crack open the can, you drink half of it in the first, you know, thirst quenching gulps, but not in a stout. You take your time. It's not a sipping drink. I have no idea if I'm drinking and I'm killing age old traditions here, and a lynch mob will come out. But if they assembled the front of my driveway right now, good luck reaching my house. It's just ice. But yeah, anyway, so like a good drink, you know, you savor it like this coffee. I'm not going to just pound it down like I would a soda. And so a stout, like a good monster, like good drama, you build up to it. There's my metaphors, like eight of them all stacked up on each other, like a terrible stack of beer pancakes.
But that does remind me that I think a good RPG is a lot like a good meal.
How so?
I think that, like, when we eat, it's one of the only social things we can do using all five of our senses at the same time.
Huh.
We hear the clinking of the glass and even the smacking of food. We smell the food.
Yep.
We taste the food. We also see the vibrant decorations of people eating, and as well as the food itself. We also
feel the food.
Feel the food. Yeah, the texture as well. And yep. I think I read somewhere, I don't know, I was doing some searching around and found out that communities that eat with their hands have more of a colloquial family style feel. And so, you know, I know in my world, my culture, a lot of times tacos symbolize that family meal. And I wondered many times, like, is that because we're eating with our hands? And I had a friend of mine, comida sabe mejor cuando está comiendo con las manos, and food tastes best when it's eaten from your hands, is what that meant. And it always stuck with me. I'm like, I think that's true. I think there's something about eating together, and what I believe it does is it does some kind of bond and connection. And so you take that a step further into business, and you think about those big business deals done over like sushi and sake.
Oh yeah.
You know, like high end, high, big pressure. But what is it? It's done over a simple meal with usually eaten, well, maybe not with hands, I guess with, you know, chopsticks or forks or however you do it. But it's a simple exchange of food and drink. And if you think about even like meeting someone for a first date, usually involves some kind of food. And I think that's a lot why food is represented in RPGs, because we know inherently that food and drink connects us. And the more often we do that together, you build compounding relationships. Huh. And if you think about it, when you're mad at someone, it's really hard to eat with them. It's awkward. And it's like, you can hear every clink of the fork or sip of the water is a testament to the silence that is between you.
Good point. So, that's true.
I think develop from the point of planning the meal, developing the meal, to serving the meal, to even enjoying the post meal is a lot like a dungeon master or a game master preparing a game. I've found so many patterns to that.
Yeah, very cool. I, you know, my beef with published adventures these days, at least the larger ones, is they're texts that you have to memorize and study. And you can tell when a game master is like 1 or 2 seconds behind on a published adventure, not just from the page flipping, but they're just especially if the adventure doesn't give them logic for them to make deductions and kind of carry the game forward. Nope. They have to understand and remember and try to figure out what the module wants, not what they want. And you can see the brain conflict going on there, the delays and the lack of confidence and stuff. And so, and then I'm encouraging people to homebrew in the newsletter, because you internalize it. You not only remember it, but you understand it. And then because you understand it, you can think it. So if somebody does something, a player does something you don't expect, then you can draw upon all of the thinking that you've done in lateral fashion, or, you know, sideways fashion, of all the stuff that you've built. And you can say, okay, well, I can pull this ingredient like a chef, and this ingredient, and here's the new situation that I didn't prepare for. But do that in a published module. And then my thing is, I always make a wrong decision, and I have to then spend time fixing, getting the party back on track for what the published module needs next. I'm just terrible at maintaining that continuity of story logic. So it, as a metaphor of eating, that's really good, because I'm learning to cook, which we talked about before, and understanding the ingredients and how the doing things in certain sequences develop certain kind of tastes and odors and textures. Yeah, it's all different when you do it yourself than ordering something that comes in a bag. So yeah, really, really cool metaphor. Yeah, excellent. No, I'm just reading. I still read published adventures. I just like to see form ideas and form opinions about how to write adventures, how to create adventures. So one of them was in the box text, the adventures step forward, and the envoy handed each of them a thing, and the characters opened the thing, and then each character got, you know, X. But holy cow, like I would, in a regular game, I would never make the characters actions for them. I would never make them step forward. I would never make them just receive the gift or the thing, the potentially trapped or poisoned thing. I would never have them open the thing. And so, yeah, in published adventures, I think WotC modules and the Pathfinder modules are pretty good about that. But it's the other less experienced designers that do that to a GM. And there's a difference. If it's a campaign starter, that's fine. There's a point I say when, okay, you now have control of your characters. Yeah. Everything else I'm controlling just to, you know, set the scene. I want at least one predictable moment in the entire campaign. Yeah.
You know, I was going to ask you about that, because I told a GM the other day, okay, when you're starting a campaign, it's okay to say, bada bing, bada boom, this is where you begin, and this is what is happening. And this is, I was saying, this is the last time you will be able to tell the player, this is the decision you made.
Yes. Yeah.
Until, and I think,
control their minds. Yeah.
Yeah. The example was, you're broke, busted, and disgusted. You know, you're down on your luck, and you're lying in a ditch.
Yeah.
Bottle of alcohol. And that's it. That's it. And my hands are off the wheel. Now, how do you proceed? Because I think you have to, it's like, oh, back to that baking recipe or baking metaphor. You have to start, get that starter of yeast to get the adventure going.
Yeah.
And I think it's a madhouse if you tell players to start it for you. And I did that one time. I didn't start the adventure, and it was like 2 to 3 sessions before there was any adventure happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it takes longer painful.
For the party to gel.
Yeah. It was painful. And then my brain is telling me, like, there's no logical sense why these people should be together.
Yeah.
They should be home. It should be safe. Why are they risking life and limb? And that bothered my mind.
I've made that mistake many, many times. A lot depends on your players. So if you have theater players and they're used to improv, then they have this, they put the energy into making bonds with their fellow players and making the GM's life easier on purpose, consciously. But the majority of players don't think that way. And so, yeah, herding the cats after you give over control at the start is very difficult. It's better to put them on a trajectory and ideally through a horizon event, like a goal, as opposed to a push event where all they do is they're tethered to the past in some way. So I agree. And so I set the stage. It's a hard-coded railroad, whatever you want to call it, but here's exactly the situation. And then Now, like the reverse matrix, Anderson, you now all inhabit the bodies of the characters as of now, and I'm no longer controlling your characters. Although I do have a you got really drunk table where the players, if they choose to drink too much, they make a saving throw and then they roll. And so in my Murder Hobos campaign, the druid woke up in the forest naked, all covered in blood. And so they lost all their stuff. So they had to go on a quest to go find where they, you know, dropped their staff and where they did this and that. And of course, the thing that they murdered. So the rolling on the table comes with some risk, but that's about the only other time I take control of the character.
Kudos to you. Like, you know, it's just a good model. It's solid.
Yeah.
It makes so much sense and it's so easy to teach. And I think when you have good content, it's just that easier to teach and explain.
So. Yeah. For whatever reason, a lot of stuff was stripped away. So when you get down to something that's simple, then people feel empowered to use it as a tool. So a hammer is pretty simple in design. A saw is very simple in design. But a table saw that I saw at a department store the other day I was looking at had, I don't know, it was like 60 functions or something. And, you know, it's got miter and it's got this and it's got that. And, you know, I backed away slowly. Hammer and saw still works.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm switching gears a little bit here and thinking like, you know, what are like the most misunderstood rules of RPGs? And we talked a little bit about movement, how that's kind of wonky or like slipping on ice, for example. What's the rules for that are pretty generous to the player's success, where in our world, it's very difficult to walk on ice.
Awesome. Yeah, learning RPGs and skills, a lot depends on game system. And I would argue, actually, it's almost entirely based on the dependent on the game system. And the game systems to me are like art. And let's choose painting as the medium of art that I'm going to talk about. So there are the realists, and then there are those who create abstract art, and those who create art purely on meaning. Like I love Salvador Dali. And then there are more representational art. And so you have to look at a game system. No, sorry. If you look at a game system through that lens, you can see how much of a simulation, how much in the game corner and how much in the set, sorry, in the setting corner, which is the simulation corner, a game is trying to achieve. And so you get the really complex rules games. You have Battletech, which is not an RPG. There is a Battletech RPG, but the Battletech war game is heavy, heavy on the simulation side. Certain things like Rollmaster and whatnot try to simulate certain things. And then you have, those that are story. So Blades in the Dark doesn't try to simulate a universe, and it doesn't try to reproduce reality in some very, you know, in a way that you could just say, oh, well, if it works in Blades in the Dark, I can try it in real life and succeed, because it's not based on that. So just like a painting can be, I'm drawing it to be realistic, or I'm drawing it to have an impression and an effect and experience. And usually it's both, but, that's where I start. And so if a game system is not trying to simulate a very specific aspect of reality, then what is there to misunderstand about rules that are there to create an effect? And therefore, I think it's the GM does not understand the philosophy or the paradigm of that game system. And when they try to GM it, they're trying to GM it like a realistic painting. And it's more of a pointillist, or it's more of an abstract kind of a painting. But if they understand, oh, I am now channeling Dali, I'm going to run it like Dali, and Blades in the Dark now comes to its full game design potential because the GM is running the game like the game designer had intended it. Whereas if you run Rollmaster or another like Harn or other, Mithras, and other games that have more complicated mechanics and attempt to mirror reality, then you have people don't understand attacks of opportunity. Is it when you enter a square or leave a square? People don't understand how to do mass battles, and people don't understand. So it's a tough question to answer in a general sense. But what do you think? What in your experience, what do you think?
I see that now. Asking the question, I betrayed that my thought was trying to recreate reality through a fantasy role-playing game, which is not my intention. Never has been.
No.
I've never tried to recreate reality, but more like impressions of human experiences. I know sometimes in my game, I would think of a real story in my life. And I would think, how would this look like in a fantasy world with fey creatures and demons and devils?
Love
what
it.
Is it
yeah.
like? What is it like to be experience this? And then I would go through the, you know, like a bestiary or a monster manual, think, oh, that monster really represents night terrors or something like that.
Yeah, that monster's going to leave a blue spot for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's what I think. I don't have a lot of experience with, I mean, the four kinds of art you described, but I think leaving impressions on people's experiences, because I think, you know, as many people as there are fewer experiences, but it's the person going through that experience that informs how that experience was portrayed or understood. And taking everyone, or what I mean everyone, like all the players at the table at the same time through that similar experience, it creates simpatico, it creates understanding and camaraderie, brothers in arms, which is a very powerful feeling. It's hard to ignore that feeling you have. So I know in my games, I like reskinning life experiences.
Nice.
Yeah, that's what I like doing. And I have gotten a little bit of feedback from people who kind of look at me and say, wait, I think I know what you're doing. That was really good. I feel like you simulated something that I have experienced in my life, and I kind of won. I won this time. My character won, excuse me. But I got to experience that feeling of winning.
Yep.
Yeah. I had one player, I think I was introducing devils in the game, and they were cunning and crafty, and you know, they got all the time in the world, so they love toying with mortals. Well, I didn't know
corporate executives for sure.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that, but you said it. Okay, go ahead. I didn't know it at the time, but my player, he was joining with his kids. He sells like $1 million steel rigging equipment or something. I mean, his art of the deal is perfect. And so he took me to school and took my villain, my horrible devil to school. I was like, whoa, I'm going to have to completely change the game because I know who this person is now.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, not only did I learn some incredible techniques of negotiation from him and learned how to deal with like this super optimized player at the table.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an optimized player. Like, so it's very difficult to present a negotiation role-playing challenge to him and come out feeling like I won. But all of the other players, of course, enjoyed him at the table because they had no problem with devils outsmarting them anymore. But I think that was fun too, because he enjoys that in his life. He loves closing that deal.
Yeah. And he probably enjoys being able to say things that he cannot do in real life. The bounds are a little bit different for him. And so that's fantasy sandbox time for him. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so with no experience with role-playing games and just kind of starting it because he was just trying to connect with his son, he walked away from that, you know, 2-year experience like, I could do this often. This is great. And he could see how it would be beneficial for coworkers to come together.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
And solve a challenge in a simulation experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Half the battle of the storming portion of teams. What is it? Storming. No. Forming, storming, norming, and performing, I think. Is the rhyming version of human manipulation in a team environment. But anyways, yeah, half of it is just understanding the other person. So, that person cuts me off. I can never finish a sentence around that person. But after a while, oh, that's just them. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't take it as a personal affront now. I don't like being interrupted in general. though I interrupt. So, you know, I have that kind of double standard going on, which I'm trying to fix. But still at work, if I'm interrupted by the new person, it's like, that's rude. And I have a point to make. That's why I'm making noise right now. Why are you stopping me? And generally not to grandstand, but just convey information. But once you understand that that player's mannerism is that, or that they do this or they do that, and it's different to you and it's counter to your worldview, then eventually you get to understand them. And then they just become a friend who does that. And you become their friend. You do that to them in your own way. And it's good times.
Yeah, I think that's believing the best in each other.
Right. Yeah. Nice.
That's something my wife and I introduced. We talked about is, am I believing the best right now about you and this person? When it comes to interrupting, one of my paradigm shifts was going away from, they're taking away my meager ration of attention, poor little me. And I shifted it to, oh, they are so excited about this topic. They're hanging on to the coattails of my idea. They're so excited. They want to jump in the pool and splash around this idea with me. And that one shift helped me understand there's a certain type of learner and type of person that does enjoy jumping into ideas cannonball style.
Yeah, yeah.
Oftentimes that looks like, oh, and like that interrupting. So I think simple shifts like that can help you realize, like you said, I'm making a friend. I'm not believing they woke up this morning with their to-do list, like make John's life miserable.
That's tomorrow. But yeah, you're right. Okay. You're right. Exactly.
Well, yeah.
So it's always been a bane of GM's existence of player knowledge versus character knowledge. And a classic example that recurred in my inbox many times was players who knew archery or martial arts. And then they came to the table with their understanding of reality, which is much greater than my own, on what is possible, what is plausible, what is probable. And so to GM them then becomes a problem, because they'll, without understanding the spirit of role play and abstraction, they will want to correct the rules. They will want to change the way that you are adjudicating things based on their knowledge. So with your player who is the master negotiator, my answer to you is to come up with alien minds. And he is counting on rationality of human rationality. And he is counting on certain social techniques working, like the last person to speak generally loses. No, is it the first person to speak after a trial close loses the sale in salespeople language?
Yeah.
Glengarry, Glenn Ross style, right?
Yeah,
and so all these little manipulation techniques and things. But yeah, throw in. So as GMs, we try to make things rational to ourselves so then we can portray them properly to players. And therefore we kind of make knowable, understandable, logical game pieces for players to interact with. And you can throw those players off with a handcrafted hand bow that doesn't obey archery rules, that can't shoot around corners, or that is rapid reload or whatever. And you can have the alien mind that doesn't respond in a way that the master negotiator gets cues from their real world experience.
So I'm going to take that maybe out farther. So I'm thinking of another player I had who was an accountant.
Okay.
And I don't have a strong money mind or financial mind. And oftentimes my wife will joke that I'll add zeros to numbers. And to me, it's just arbitrary. Like, oh yeah, it was like 1,000 people there. And she's like, you mean 100, you know? So I know I've been corrected many times when it comes to numbers. And so when I started using gold and price and value in the game, a lot of times I would just go for the shock value or the underwhelming value of the sale, buying a magic sword. And the accountant I could see him like bucking the rules, but he's a very polite, soft-spoken guy. But I could still feel he was like wincing at my egregious use of money in the game. So I picked that up and I said, hey, you're an accountant. Yeah, I'm probably butchering this whole system for you. Like, I am not an accountant, but I'm still running the game. Can we like work together a little bit and figure out some way that's not, you know, suspending your brain and belief but is also allowing me to continue as the game master. And we developed really quickly like an equivalency. Cool. So that at least in our current day economy, gold felt about the same.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if I shared it with someone right now, they'd be like, actually, you know, so I'm not going to share it, but it was enough of a quick rule system so that his brain wasn't constantly being, you know, ramrodded with this ridiculous fantasy. And then I had another player who was a martial artist and he played a monk.
Okay,
martial artist.
Yeah, lovely.
And it was just, I mean, pretty much the first few sessions we had to, which was great. And I always do like a debriefing at the end of my games, you know, like a scars and wishes, or excuse me, stars and wishes. Yep. But oftentimes there were scars in the game. And he said like, okay, we gotta work together on this. And I was like, okay, well, what do you want to do? He's like, well, I want to do this move and this move. And I think it's very unrealistic that this could happen. So he laid out all this stuff and I pushed hard on like, well, but we're going to stick within the class. Now, flavor-wise, like description-wise, I want you to go with that. And at this point that I'm entertained, I might give you some leeway. Because to be quite honest, we're all enjoying your descriptions of how you're dismantling your foe. But this is an immortal devil you're grappling. And he's like, yeah, right. Oh, yeah, I understand. I was like, he doesn't have a spine. Like the creature does not have a skeletal structure. So,
yeah.
You know, there's like you going back to what you said about that alien mind. So I think you can do both. You can kind of like expand your fantasy world and say, yeah, but the rules of reality don't apply here. But then I think it's also fun to work with the player, especially if it's their expertise.
Yeah.
When my player's a writer, for example, I let him write, you know, 1,000-page backstory, go ahead, bring it to the table, have scripts prepared of what you want to say, because their mind does lots of pre-planning. And so you force them into an RPG game, which is very present. A lot of times they'll fumble and they'll fluster and they'll be upset, like, it didn't go out the way I wanted it to, because their writer mind is so used to having everything laid out before the production. So I think like it's that balance between working with your players as far as like, well, how much work do you want to do as a player? Would you mind helping me tweak the system a little bit? Plant lovers and herbologists.
Yeah.
I mean, they know the flora and fauna really well. And so when they bring to me like a world building moment, like, oh, this fern here, I found it and it has healing properties. I'm like, oh, so that's how you cast cure wounds. Yes. You know,
yeah,
so kind of bridge the gap so we're not constantly rewriting a system, but also doing what I think is the one of the strongest ways to increase value in a game is to increase participation.
Yeah,
I agree. Let's all put our hands in the recipe and make this together.
Yeah. So when you asked about, you know, which mechanics have the most or least understood, the reason, like, I think I frustrate people sometimes because I focus so much on the game corner of the GM triangle. And it's because we have agreed to sit down and play a game. And I had a discussion in the Discord about whether you should use meta bonuses to reward for good role playing, whether you should reward players versus the natural outcomes of gameplay. And so that's a philosophical debate we can have in the future. But my opinion is, because there's agency in this game, certain amount of player agency, the problem is give an inch, take a mile. And in when I played Monopoly, it used to be my favorite game, no one ever argued with me about the breed of the dog. It's a Scotty dog. Everybody, whether it was a piece of the metal to them or pewter, or it was actually, they would, you know, bark as they walked around the board. That no one ever can question that, but you have that little extra agency in role playing, or a lot of extra agency sometimes in some GMs in a role playing game. Now you have a problem mapping actual reality to the game mechanics. And so when you look at combat, for example, almost every game system has a conflict resolution system, which is thoroughly abstracted. In D&D, it's a fight to the last hit point, and you suffer. Your condition is the same at one hit point as it is at 100 and zero, at 100 and 1,000. So in a conversation I had with Alan or Exile in Paradise in the forum, he listed all the mechanics that were missing for him in, or just in general, in D&D 5e for combat. Things like chases and things like mass battles and things where different maneuvers. And so 5e has a set of combat mechanics that involve push and grapple and things like that. But just as a human in on Earth, you're going to want to match your expectation of outcomes to the game and expecting something there. And that's really tricky. So I think actually every mechanic is possibly difficult for a GM in that sense.
Yeah, I think so too. Speaking of combat, I follow someone on social media. They're called Sellsword Arts, and they're amazing acrobats. And okay. I think they mostly perform as stunt doubles. They teach parkour and body mechanics and things like that. And he does two different kinds of lessons, like video lessons. He does one where he teaches fencing and swordplay. And he teaches it from a very realistic perspective. This is how you do a longsword. This is what you attack with a bastard sword. And he does all the mechanics. And then he does like mockery videos of like, this is why Hollywood got it wrong, which I realize like, yeah. And he does it in a very, it's not condescending or anything. He's just explaining like, this is how reality works. This is why spins don't work. Like you lose momentum. The game is to close the closest point between A and B. It's not to flourish.
Yeah,
but it looks cool. And so they also do this other channel or a series of shorts where they simulate like Skyrim, they simulate Assassin's Creed, they simulate all these cool games. It's like, yeah, that looks amazing. And it's that, I think there's both. There's like that desire for realism in the game, and there's also that desire for flourish because it looks cool.
Yeah.
And I think doing both, I think the challenge is like, when do you alternate? When do you tell your players, surprise, here's the gritty realism of the game. And when do you tell your players, like, it's time to embellish?
Yeah.
And so I don't know, like, I don't know if that upsets many players to have a GM who's constantly throttling between the back and forth.
To me, it's not either or alternating, it's stacking. So once you master your game system, you can think the game system to produce basically the laws of physics that are your game world. And now you can educate your players on those, and then they can start thinking and making decisions and embellishing. And so I see it as stacking, or all three sides of a three-sided coin, and not either or. But it definitely, some viewpoints, it could definitely be either or. It's a tricky thing. Ultimately, I think the players game and make decisions and communicate to you with an expectation of an outcome that they have in their mind. And if you run the game in a way that those outcomes are nullified or nerfed or mitigated through what the player will feel is arbitrary or subjectivity, you have the conflict that comes up, which is probably almost my number one complaint in my inbox over the years, is problem players. But the problem players are usually problem GMs who do not understand what the players are expecting and facilitate in such a way to bridge that gap. Like in a compromise, both sides have to eventually meet in the middle point. It's not good if one side is always going all the way over to the other camp. But the GM needs to be the leader in that respect. Another conversation, I think for another time, a whole lot to unpack there. But I do believe that the game corner is a foundation and critical. If everybody is channeling that, then all the hand waving and the house rules and the meta bonuses can stack on top of that. But my argument is that in most cases, you are trying to fill a gap with the wrong tool. And until you see the gap for what it is, and this is me saying, you know, I have this understanding, maybe I'm misunderstanding the entire world, but if you see the gap then and pick the right tool, then your game flows. For example, if you do not understand probability, you're going to use bonuses and gimmies and hand waves because you do not understand how basically the odds generate the reality of your campaign. So if you look back in the campaign, was it harrowing or too simple? Was it full of unbelievable, like hard to believe things, or a series of choices that built up and built up and built the tension and built the negative possible consequences, the stakes and stuff? And I believe all that is based on, in part, on system mastery.
Yes, that is very true. And I think, like, you know, going back to building your craft, you know, like my friend that understands the 60 function table saw and knows how to write the computer program to program that table saw so you can push a button and boom, there's your wonderful crafted furniture, as long as all the parts work. I mean, that takes time to understand. Yeah. And I think that's the exciting part about being a GM, is learning the systems and looking at that dice and realizing, wait a second. Every time I roll this, I'm risking something. And that was a big aha for me. And that could be a big aha for a GM, you know, listening, is that, what does the dice mean? Why do you use it? It's to determine an outcome. And it's kind of like what you said, that game mastery, that game system is what we're all agreeing upon.
Yeah.
And so when the game master lets go of the wheel and says, okay, we're going to roll to see what happens, or you roll to see what happens, that's determining. It's kind of like that. I mean, you still have to interpret it, but you're letting that fate decide versus, you know, John, you say, I intend to shoot this skeleton through the head. Okay. You succeed. And, you know, you progress forward. If there's no level of try, then you just progress forward with the story. We agree upon that. But if there's some level of difficulty, because I'm acting as the agent for this skeleton wanting to preserve its life, well, I'm going to try and duck out of the way, or I'm going to try to evasive maneuver, it produces some difficulty. So I think that may be a good step or a good like takeaway. What I heard in all that is, make sure you listen to your players and ask them, what do you intend to do? What are you hoping to accomplish here? What do you intend to do? Well, I intend to climb to the tree to get safe away from all these people. Oh, okay. My bad. I was thinking you were trying to do this. And that could be a good way to smooth out that frustration of unmet expectations. Mm-hmm. Just asking that simple question, John, what are you intending to do? Well, I'm intending to distract the genie so we can get away. Okay, well, that's not as difficult as distracting him so you could assassinate him, right? It's easier to skirt away because you're such a small person compared to his large size. So intention is very powerful.
Agreed. Yeah, I've got musings there talking about if you can handle, if you can figure out the why and the what, then you can just let the players do the when and the how. And so if you understand the player's intention, so that's the why, and then the how they're going to do it. So that's actually the what, even though I just said how, but like, what are you doing? It's up to the players to decide how their characters act and the choices mm-hmm. they make. And so that can relieve the GM of a lot of that mental load. They don't have to worry about anticipating what the players will do. They mm-hmm. need to figure out the intention. And then now you have that, you can do the deduction and the inference based on system, story, and setting mastery, yeah, for sure.
Well said.